Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate New York author Nicole Harutunian. Her fiction has appeared in the Georgia Review, Story, Tupelo Quarterly, The Bennington Review, Joyland, Post Road, Pigeon Pages, Tin House's Open Bar, and elsewhere. Her debut collection of short stories, Speed Dreaming, was published by Little A in 2015. Her novel in stories, Choose This Now, was just released in March by Noemi Press. Today we're going to be presenting her story, Three Times I Breathed Other People's Breath and No One Worried About Death. But first, here's my interview with Nicole, which took place on March 22nd of this year. I'd like to welcome Nicole Harutunian to the podcast. How are you today, Nicole?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to see you again. I was able to come to your book launch at P&T Knitwear in New York City. That was last Friday. It's been just exactly a week. And what a great event that was. You had an incredible turnout. The place was packed and it was so much fun. It was moderated by our friend Ananda Lima, who's also going to be on the podcast. And it was kind of a family affair. Your daughter, Opal, got to read her poem that night. That was something very different from what I'm used to as these book launches. And then you did some audience participation stuff, too. You had a masquerade, masks, plain paper ones that people were able to decorate. I know there's some great photographs of that on your Instagram page, I think, right?
Yeah, there are. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that all struck you. I'm a museum educator and I can't turn it off sometimes. I gotta have an art activity.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of that working its way in there. Let's talk about your beginnings because, you know, you have an interesting path to writing. I think you began as an art major, getting back to the subject you were just on. Is that right?
Well, it's definitely right. I took probably an equal number of art and writing classes in undergrad. And I just didn't double major because a lot of my family at the time and still live in Europe. And I'd always taken French class because my grandmother spoke French and Farsi and Armenian, but not English. And so I wanted to study in Paris, and I couldn't double major in art and English and study in Paris and graduate on time. So I was like, I don't really need to take Beowulf and Chaucer and all that. So rather than majoring in English, I just took the English classes I wanted to take. So I took creative writing, I think almost every semester when I was in undergrad, but technically majored in studio art. So I was always doing it, just maybe a little stealth.
And your medium was paint, oil paint?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was a painter.
Mm. At the event, the book launch, you know, you did speak about that a bit and mentioned that you sort of fell out of love with painting in a way. And what were your, just for the listeners, your reasons that you've decided that that was not the right place for you and that writing would be?
Yeah, I always really liked doing art, looking at art, thinking about art, talking about art. And I was good, like technically pretty good. So that when you're younger carries you pretty far. But then at a certain point, I don't think like a painter or think like a visual artist. It was sometimes fun for me to make paintings and maybe they looked good, but there wasn't a lot of like idea behind it necessarily. And I wasn't super interested in making it that way. But when people would point that out or be critical, I would get like annoyed and it would make me want to stop rather than make me want to like prove them wrong or fix it. Whereas if I got critiques in writing class, I would either be like, no, I'm right and I'm going to do it my way. Or I would be like, oh, you're right. And I can't wait to get in there and fix it. And I was like sort of more energized and inspired by like talking about the ideas behind my writing and what I was trying to do and how it was hitting people. And it just became kind of more consuming and more interesting to me. And I think that I came to realize that I was a writer and I wasn't a painter. And there's nothing wrong with painting for fun, but I don't even really do that unless I'm doing it in a museum with students or with my kid. I just like I don't have that sort of impulse anymore. Maybe if I didn't live in New York City in like a little apartment and I could have like some space and like have a painting set up, maybe I would feel compelled to do it sometimes, but I really don't. But I am around art all the time and talking about art all the time for my job. And I think that that is really where my art practice is just like facilitating experiences and sustained conversations and like getting in there with other people's art, with communities. So I think that kind of does what I want to do with art. I don't need to make it myself.
And tell us a little bit about that, the job that you were just mentioning.
So it's something that people don't necessarily know much about, even if they've experienced it. Because I'm not a docent. I think a docent traditionally like tells you about the exhibition that you're visiting at a museum. I might do some of that, but what I try to do is get people to like really feel comfortable and empowered to experience and understand and kind of trust themselves in making meaning from the art or the exhibits. So I work with very diverse audiences, all different kinds of folks and groups. And we tend to spend like a lot of time maybe with one artwork. Maybe it will, in an hour, we'll look at 3 to 5 artworks. And through conversation and through activities, through like making connections, personal, contextual, between the art, just try to get people to really like spend time with and appreciate the art for themselves in their own way, kind of take from it what is going to be meaningful for them. So it's a lot of art making, it's a lot of conversation, guided conversation.
And some of that experience I noticed finds its way into your book, Choose This Now.
It sure does,
One of the
yeah.
characters, Talin Tal, is someone who is immersed in that world. And there are moments, where she's leading students. Sometimes they're adult administrator school administrators, sometimes they're kids, through those sorts of exercises. And it's clear that this is something that you know a lot about. I think the book makes it clear that you, even though you have not continued to pursue a career as a visual artist, you know so much about art and art theory and history. And I learned a lot reading the book about modern figures that I didn't know about. That's always one of the fun parts for me in reading a book and reading stories, is being able to look up a name and go, oh, and see the actual work of art, that you're
Yeah.
just that you're describing, because these are real people that you're mentioning in the story, and very influential artists, people who often had political agendas. So I appreciate that in Choose This Now. So I want to talk a little bit about Noemi Press and the experience you've had with them. This manuscript was chosen, I believe, as part of a contest. Is that how that worked?
Yeah, it didn't win. I think that they're not doing a prose contest currently, but it used to be a yearly prose contest, and I submitted my manuscript, and it didn't win, but they wanted to publish it anyway, which is amazing. So, yeah, it was one of the their 3 spring books this year. They just do like a very limited bunch of books at a time. So mine was the prose book for this spring.
And that was John Darcy, was the gentleman who decided he wanted to work on this. And I applaud him for having the good sense to pick this up and run with it, because it's a tremendous piece of writing. I was so immersed in this as I was reading it. And you've created these unforgettable characters. They're just so fully realized. And it's basically five women at the center whose friendships we're following chronologically in the book. And it's shifting narratives, which is another really interesting choice that you made. They're first person narratives, and it's moving forward in time. And the narrators shift from one character to another. So you're getting these different perspectives. So the use of time and the passage of time takes on real significance in the book. And, you know, it made me think in terms of form. One of the things that I was reading in the acknowledgments, the first meeting that you had with two of the women from Noemi, you said something like, but this book isn't really a novel and it isn't really a short story collection. And they said, yes, true. So what? So did the book change a lot in form from the original manuscript that you submitted to this final version of Choose This Now?
Yes and no. So I think it was more of a linked collection when I sent it in, and it emerged as a novel in stories, which maybe doesn't sound like radically different, but it became a lot more unified. The world became a lot more unified. And I did some real surgery, like swapping characters in and out, which then necessitated like changing the stories themselves, because what one character would do, another one wouldn't necessarily, because I kind of combined people. The story has this, or the book has a central friendship between these two women. Initially, it was more like four women. So when I sort of condensed some of those characters, the form kind of changed along with that. And it's hard to even remember exactly how the morphing happened, because I just worked on it for 2 years. And after I kind of got started, I like that part, like the shaping the stories part, shaping the book part. So I wasn't too precious about it. I lost one character entirely. She got like subsumed into somebody else. And then one became, she's still in there. She has one third person story in her point of view now, but she's sort of more like a foil for the other two, where she used to kind of have her own stories a little bit more. So like, to me, it's radically different, but I don't know if it would be radically different to a reader. But my editor, he mentioned John Darcy. He was pretty instrumental in like encouraging that change. He wasn't prescriptive at all. He gave me options. He said he would have supported anything I wanted to do. But he was like, I think either this book becomes more separate stories or it becomes more novel. And I'm going to leave it up to you. But next time we meet, tell me what you think. And then when I met with him the second time, I was like, I think it's a novel. And he was like, I think it's a novel. So that's sort of how that form kind of shift happened.
And, you know, I think that is a good example of how things are kind of shifting in the way the publishing world is looking at things. A novel is no longer what people used to think of as a novel. You know, there's like many, the lines are blurring between linked short story collections, novels and stories, as this one is. This podcast is Short Story Today, and it's, you know, I have short story writers on, and you are a short story writer. You have a book that preceded this, Speed Dreaming, right? That was published by Big A Press.
Little A.
Yeah, Big A would be a whole different thing, wouldn't it? Little A. And that got a tremendous reception when that came out. I was looking at the press that you got.
That's yeah. Generous of you.
Well, I mean, it's unusual for, you know, a debut collection to get that kind of attention. It was reviewed by someone at the Paris Review.
Yeah, that was amazing. You're right about that one.
Yeah. And I mean, you had Joan Silber did a review, or blurbed it at least.
Blurbed it, yeah.
Yeah, you got some serious contenders paying attention to you from that. So let's just spend a few minutes talking about what that experience was like for you, getting that published first.
Sure. And I just want to affirm what you said about me being a short story writer. So even though I'm calling this one a novel in story, I mean, it's definitely also a story collection. Each chapter stands on its own, and I think in stories. And maybe they build to a novel, but I definitely write stories. So the first one, there was a little bit of a similar like editorial arc where the book started a little bit more disparate. And then my editor, who is Ed Park, who is, you know, one of the most incredible writers out there and editors, he was like, so you've got these two stories, the protagonists have different names, they're definitely the same person. Can we just acknowledge that they're the same person? Or like this one story is set in Pittsburgh and you've got this other story set in Poughkeepsie. That one has to be in Poughkeepsie. let's just change the Pittsburgh one to Poughkeepsie because that makes much more sense. And I was like, oh, I think that my instinct was because they were stories, I thought they should be different from each other. And I was like making the characters different just for the sake of like, I think that you should be able to tell them apart in this book. And he was like, but why? It's the same person. You're writing about somebody making the exact same kind of choices. They seem like the same person. Just, it's the same person. This is a linked collection. And I was like, oh yeah, you're totally right. Like, this is all the same world. It's all this, these people, like the band that's playing in this story is probably the band that that person's in that story. He helped me kind of acknowledge that it's fine to be writing about people who seem really similar because they're the same person. And I think the short story writer thing was kind of tripping me up there. So he was really amazing to work with. Little A was great to work with during the editorial process. They published really cool work by writers who might not have gotten published other places. So they're, I don't know if everybody's familiar with them, but they're the literary publishing wing of Amazon. And this was like 10 years ago. And the way I was kind of pitched about it is they were taking like Amazon money and publishing work that maybe wouldn't get published elsewhere, which seemed great. And then my editor quit before my book came out. So I got to edit it with him. So like the art benefited, but then it was a little sad. It was a little rough because then I was like a little bit adrift. I did get assigned another editor, but she hadn't worked on the book with me. So it wasn't, but I, you know, that's how it works in publishing. I feel like almost everybody has that kind of story. So I didn't go back to them because my relationship was with my editor there. So I did appreciate the time I had with him a lot. And I think the book was as good as it could be because of that experience.
Well, that was lucky. At least you got pretty much to the end of the necessary work before he decided to leave. But I'm sure that was a difficult thing for you to have to face at that point. I haven't had a chance to read that. I'm looking forward to moving to that one next.
This one is so much better. Just read the
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to read everything you write, Nicole. Obviously, you know, I you're a truly gifted writer, and I do love this book. And it's just so unusual. You know, I have to say, as a reader, it took a little getting used to at first, getting the lay of the land, so to speak, and understanding the form, you know, that you'd chosen.
Yeah.
But it made me want to, at the end, want to go right back to the beginning and reread it from the start. because you really just fall in love with these characters. They're so recognizable in so many ways. And relationships with men are central, you know, in the lives of these women and the men that they choose. And yet there's this one character you've kind of kept shrouded in mystery who really kind of sets the whole story in motion. Elliot Thomas, who, you know, when the story starts in 1999 and all of these characters are at college together, you know, he's sort of the object of everyone's desire. You know, he's this kind of mysterious character. And I mean, they're even playing like spin the bottle at this Halloween party that starts the book off, and everybody wants to have his attention. And then something kind of terrible happens at the beginning while the character Val and Elliot are out on their own. And that kind of sets everything in motion. And a lot of these relationships are affected by what happens at that point at the very beginning of the story. And the choice that Val makes in that instance. And I'm just going to ask the obvious question of choosing to do it in chronological order and put the character's name and the year of their narration at the top of each chapter. Is that something that you had from the beginning, or did that come during the editing process?
I have to think about that for a minute because it feels pretty integral now, but no, I don't think I had it at the beginning. And it actually necessitated like spreadsheets because I had to really plot out how much time had passed between each story and how old everybody would be at the time and where they were and where everybody else was. And there's actually one little like hiccup in the chronology at one point where I think it goes 2013, 2012, 2013 in the sort of last third of the book. And that kind of drew me up the wall. I was like, I can't do this. But then I had to do it. If I had made it chronological, it wouldn't have made total sense. And So I definitely needed the date there to, if anybody's like really paying close attention, doesn't make sense without the date, but narratively the stories had to be in this order. So part of it was that, and there are these leaps and like kind of things that happen off camera a lot in the book. So I wanted the markers of time to be there just to help people with that, to understand, you know, there's no reason to keep a mystery around how much time had elapsed between these things. So I was like, I feel like the easiest way to do that is instead of embedding like the date somehow in the story or having the character say like, it's been 5 years since this, I was like, I can just put the date. Why not?
Mm.
And similarly with who the story is about, because the chapters do alternate more or less between Valerie and Tallien, that central friendship. But then there's three chapters that are these third person stories of like other women in their orbit. And yeah, I just wanted it to say at the top, you know, that necessary info, just to kind of keep it clear.
Mm. No, I think it's a very helpful device. And when you have shifting narrators like that, it helps kind of ground the reader as they're moving forward in the story. I thought I only saw one third person narrative in there, the Jesus Louise chapter.
No, there's two others. There are.
Okay.
Clear
I guess.
Clear Blue, the one with Tova and the monastery. That's a third person. And then the one with the teenager. That's like pretty tangential, but she gets like a glimpse of Valerie.
Yeah, that's Lifeguard. Which I do want to talk about because that's kind of a rogue story that you that you beautifully link to some of the other characters in the novel at the end of that piece. But it's a little bit of a side trip that you take with that one, but a really interesting one. And the characters do in many ways, you know, they're experiencing similar things to what the main characters in the book are experiencing. So yeah, that was a really interesting thing. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. But going back to the third person versus the first person. So that obviously was a deliberate choice when you had these sort of secondary characters and you were telling their story, you moved from first to third person for those. It's funny, when I was going through trying to find them, I only saw that one Jesus Louise.
Because my third person is a very close third person.
Okay,
so
maybe that's...
It probably feels a little more first person.
Mm-hmm. God, there are just so many threads and topics for discussion with this book that it's hard for me to choose. Motherhood is key in the lives of these main characters. One of them, Val, she becomes a mother almost reluctantly and worries about this child kind of hijacking her life and, you know, maybe having made the wrong choice. But then we see her evolve through the book. And that's the wonderful opportunity that you give us, is that we see these people evolve in the nearly 20 years over which this book takes place. But some other characters struggle and, you know, with fertility issues. But motherhood is central to the book and the experiences of mothers, both the high points and the low points. I know you have a young daughter and, you know, I'm sure that experience is going to change your worldview and anyone who has children knows, you know, it will. But did you know, you know, that was going to be kind of a central theme that would link these characters in a particular way when you were working on this?
I think I did, yeah. I was really interested in writing about female friendship and sort of how it morphs. And the book it's not about me, but I tend to write experiences that I've had or I've observed. And there is this kind of familiar visit that people take in their, you know, for some people in some contexts, it's like in their 20s, but in New York City is more so like 30s and 40s, where you go visit your friend who's just had a baby. And maybe you hold the baby while they take a shower. And then you like hear their, you know, all the wild, wild details of this huge transformation they've been through. And you do it all in like 30 minutes while they're like maybe crying and not wearing a shirt and you're trying to like do the dishes for them. So, you know, that's something that a lot of people have been telling me, like, oh, I've never seen the new mom visit in a book. But you know, we've had so many of them. And it's one thing if you're visiting and you're a parent already, and maybe you know how to help, or you know what kind of help you would have wanted. And it's another thing when you visit that friend who's had the baby before you have your own, and you like maybe don't really get what's happening. And like your friend who's always been like one way is suddenly acting like very different. And then if you're that mom, your friend who comes in who hasn't had a kid yet, you're like, well, you have no idea what just happened to me. So there's this kind of gulf that opens up. And I thought that was really interesting to explore, like both in that moment and then how that sort of friendship kind of reforms and morphs and maybe comes back together. So I did that. I did like two of those visits. There actually used to be a third that took a super different shape that I cut out like pretty last minute. So yeah, that like motherhood, I definitely wanted to write about. And I often write about things like just after I've experienced them, maybe like a year or two later. So I remember the details, but I'm not in it anymore. Like carrying around a travel potty and like constantly having a bag of urine in your hands when you're potty training a toddler. But thankfully, that is not a visceral memory for me anymore. I can't move beyond that. But like well, I wrote about it when it was. So when I read that chapter of my book again, I'm like, oh, right. I always used to have like a bag of urine in my hand. Like disgusting.
That's a hilarious scene in the book. I love that. And there are many hilarious things in this book. You know, you take on some pretty serious subjects, but I found myself laughing a lot while I was reading the book. You know, and I mean, and there was an exchange between Talene and Val. Val has talked about being in New Jersey, and Talene says, are you a Jersey mom now? That's how you identify? And Val says, I mean, no, that makes me sound like a cow. you just have so many great exchanges between these women. Going back to, you know, the whole notion of life as you knew it is gone when a child enters your life, right? And the ideals that, you know, that we've held dear, somehow, you know, we find that we're loosening our grip on those and rationalizing things in ways that we never might have before we had children. I wanted to take a line out that I thought was really wonderful. I'd spent so many years reading and analyzing texts that reject biological determinism, interrogate ideas of what is natural, and deconstruct our assumptions about traditional gender roles and reveal them to be cultural, societal, and rooted in the patriarchy. But at 4 a.m., the fact remains that I am the one with the milk. This is Val saying this, right? You really have some wonderful philosophical observations throughout the book. There's a scene which kind of brings to mind, if anyone's seen the movie Eyes Wide Shut, that chapter is
Between Us.
Yes,
He's Between Us. Yeah, like third to last, maybe.
Wow, that was kind of an eye opener, and you know, it made me wonder. In a movie like Eyes Wide Shut, it's something that okay, you know, these things exist out there in the world, but when you think about them happening in like suburban New York or New Jersey, it's like I guess these things do happen, and it's just very few of us who are given privy to those kinds of things, yeah. Right?
I mean, I think that things like that happen. That I was at, and it wasn't quite a New Year's Eve party, but it was a party celebrating the New Year. And so we were talking about New Year's Eve parties, and this woman told a story about her friend taking her to a party with absolutely no preface. It was in a Boston suburb. And she got there and people were in different costumes, like different kind of themed costumes in every room of this huge mansion. She didn't know what was going on. And I actually don't remember anything else she told me about this real party, but that sort of sense of like slight betrayal and confusion and destabilization kind of stayed with me. And right in the moment, as she was telling that story, I was like, can I steal this and I take this idea? And she was like, well, it's not my idea. It's yeah, go for it. So I was like, I'm going to, and you're gonna see it one day. So I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I was like, I think that this is going in the book somehow.
And I saw in your acknowledgments, you give her credit, but you don't mention what it is you're thanking her for allowing you to use. I love that. So now we know. That's great. But the whole masks leitmotif that kind of recurs in the book is really, it's a wonderful thing to examine and think about. And in that chapter, there's a quote that I pulled out, masks can be more about revealing than concealing. And I think that's a really wonderful point that you make in that particular chapter. Tal has been taken there. She has no idea what she's about to step into, but the minute her friends take out these masks that cover their heads completely and give her one, which is a flamingo, she's like, I don't know about this. And she's ready to bolt, but they don't allow cell phones at this party, evidently. So she's kind of a prisoner in a way at this party. And the way it ends is really wonderful, where she decides to wander out. She can't get her phone. Everything's locked in the car, but she ends up seeing this limo full of teenagers, and it's a kind of a stunt that she pulls to get this limo to stop, and she, right. Which is really, and the kids love it. They stick their head out and they, you know, you look like somebody from a horror movie, and they have her join them. And the chapter ends with her going off in the limo with them, partying into the night. Yeah, that was so much fun. I could imagine that some of these stories were easier to write and maybe more fun and less problematic in the writing. Was that one of those?
You know, I think you're right. I think it went through like less big changes and revision than other stories. But part of what you quoted, credit has to go to my editor, John, because that her whole little discourse in there about masks, I never wanted to like really put too much emphasis on the mask thing, because I think it can be like a little easy to have masks be like your symbol. So they're in there because there's so much costumes and stuff. But he was like, you got to say something specific about masks. Like, you have to have each of these characters have like their moment where they like reconcile with the fact that they're in masks for half the book. And I was like, okay, all right. I think maybe if it comes from the character, then it's going to feel like authentic to the moment. So that part was a little hard for me, figuring out how to wedge in something like that when the story didn't initially have it and make it feel organic to the story. But everything else, I think you're right, maybe mostly, except for that it initially was a different character who went to that party. but it didn't change radically in the way some other stories changed radically and painfully for me.
Yeah. And in that story, the value placed on masks for the characters and that, you know, that it really raises the stakes, because it's all about concealing people's identities and people being allowed to just behave in a manner that they would not normally behave, because no one's concerned about those social constructs. You know, this is all about getting what you want. And, you know, I guess New Year's is a time that people think that that's permissible. I don't know. But I love that.
But it's, you know, it's a symbol for them too, because if you think about going to a party with all your friends, if they covered up their face with a mask, you still know who everybody is.
Yes.
You know, yes. They knew who everybody was.
Yes. Yes. And you make good use of that dynamic too, with Talina and another character who turns out she does know and realizes from clues that she's been given who she is later on. The book ends at a very significant time in our history. And Tal at that point has finally found the person that she wants to spend the rest of her life with, in Navid. And they have a child, Saraya. Am I pronouncing that right? Saraya, or is it Saraya?
In my head, it's Saraya.
Saraya, which is something that she has seen all her friends experience and felt sort of left out because of. And now, you know, she finally seems to have found everything that, you know, she's been looking for in this family unit with Navid and Saraya. But it's right at the time when the 2016 elections have taken place and the news is not good. And Navid is Iranian. As a translator, he is often sent to different countries. And right at this moment, he's being sent out of the country at a time when everything related to the status of immigrants in this country is kind of up in the air and in question. So there's a lot of tension in the final moments of the book, but then you do a beautiful thing in bringing the other characters back in kind of momentarily to bring everything together. So the book really kind of ends on a hopeful note, even though it's everyone is clearly terrified of, you know, what's to come. But we know that these characters are going to be okay regardless, you know, that they're all going to come out fine. And it's such a memorable book. And it is something I think that bears reading more than once. So I really am recommending that people who are listening to this go out and buy this book and read it at least once, if not more than once, because it's really wonderful.
Thank you.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about a couple of things that I was really curious about. You have on Audible, there's something that you wrote, The Puppy Adoption, which is read by Carrie Mulligan. Tell me about that. That just blew my mind when I saw that Carrie Mulligan narrates the audiobook version of that.
I know. Yeah, you know what's funny about that is that's actually not the one that gets like all the love. There's a quilt one that I wrote too, Quilt Collecting. So this was like a producer from Audible reached out to me, and it was like shrouded in secrecy for a while. And I was like really, you know, on edge about what they wanted to ask me. And I finally got on the phone with them, and my second editor at Little A had recommended me for this. And what they wanted is somebody to write, in their words, elaborately boring stories to help people sleep. And I was just stunned. I mean, sleep stories now are a thing, but when they asked me for this, it's not something I was familiar with. And I just really didn't know whether to be like honored or appalled that these people thought I could write elaborately boring stories, but I can. I did. And and one of them is narrated by Carrie Mulligan. So I mean, I had nothing to do with that part, but it was a shocking surprise. So yeah, I wrote a couple of them, and it's just to help people sort of be engaged for the very like earliest part, the first 1 or 2 minutes, and then just bore them until they fall asleep with just elaborate details, no tension whatsoever, nothing upsetting, and just like lull them to sleep.
That's hysterical. This is another example of there's really nothing new under the sun, because this is actually something as an audiobook narrator that I thought about doing. At one point I thought, you know, yeah, but just books to go, you know, if you have the kind of voice that can lull people to sleep, which people have told me I have, you know, maybe there's a market for that. But and Carrie Mulligan, you know, she has just such a lovely, rich, mellow voice, and you can't get better than that. And you never found out about, you know, how that all came together and, you know, how they got her involved in it, because that's really pretty spectacular. But I didn't notice that on your website. Do you have, you got to get a link to that on your website or?
Oh, yeah, no, I don't know. It's just such like a random thing I did. And I guess because I wasn't allowed to talk about it for so long, I don't know. It never occurred to me to put it on my website. I could do that.
I would imagine you would be getting royalties from that if it sells well.
That's not how the contract works.
No.
They did pay me pretty well to write them. But no, it was like a one-time fee.
So they give you a flat free up front. Okay. Yeah. Too bad, because I bet with Carrie Mulligan, you know, narrating them, they're probably selling pretty well out there.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. So yeah, on that subject, you don't have an agent at this point?
No, I don't. No, I did for a little bit, but no, I don't now.
Was that not a good experience?
It didn't work out. She didn't want to look at Choose This Now. She was too busy and she didn't think she could sell it. So she suggested that I try to submit it to small presses on my own or get a new agent. So I did start submitting it to small presses and querying agents at the same time, and thought like, you know, if one or the other happened, then I would go that route. And the first thing that happened was that Noemi wanted to publish it. So I remain agentless, but I would like to have an agent soon.
From the publication of this book, are there people that you can try to enlist to help you find an agent as a result of the wonderful, you know, advanced press that this has received?
I hope it works that way. I will try that. I'm going to cross my fingers. I feel like agents can be a little bit more market driven than small presses, and, you know, kind of a hybrid work that's quiet like this. It was, Noemi was like, yeah, it's great that it's in between where there are poets there, you know, but agents want to know like how much it's going to sell. So yeah, I hope so. I hope it's helpful.
Well, I think this book has broad appeal. I think so many people would relate to this. You know, I think that they would enjoy this and find it something that has a takeaway, you know, that will stay with them, which is really what separates literature from, you know, the other stuff, is that if it stays with you and you continue to think about it, that's what we all as readers, you know, for me, that's what I look for. And this, I think, delivers in that way. So I really hope that it finds its way out there. I wish you nothing but good luck, Nicole. And I hope that you get the attention that you deserve, because I think you're a super gifted writer. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of what you're going to bring to this category of art. So thank you for coming today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. This has been really nice.
To find additional information about Nicole's books, links to her short stories, and information about upcoming events, visit her website, NicoleHarutunian.com. And now we'll move on to the short story. There's already an audiobook edition of Choose This Now, and copyright restrictions prevent us from performing anything from that book. So we're going to bring you a story that was published in the Tupelo Quarterly. Three times I breathed other people's breath and no one worried about death, which will be read by Sierra Lidien. So here it is. Three times I breathed other people's breath and no one worried about death, by Nicole Harutunian.
There was the time Lulu and I took the train three stops further into Brooklyn from her place, navigating off of directions scrawled on the back of an envelope, finding ourselves in front of an unmarked door that looked like it couldn't be anything but a place we weren't supposed to be. But when we pulled the handle, the door opened and there we were. It was an absolutely enormous space that offered, even more amazingly, almost no room to move, stuffed wall to wall and up to the ceiling with all manner of used furniture and household detritus, as if all the world's garage sales had been consolidated into this one place. We'd sneezed and then sneezed again. The strong summer light barely filtered through the filthy windows near the ceiling of the place, but once inside, its dim rays split into rainbows every which way, broken into color by the humidity and the dust and the mirrors and plate glass and old crystal vases crammed into each and every available spot. We almost bought a splintering rowboat. Close, we said. Almost. I made her walk away from a yellowing wedding dress she was fingering a little too wistfully. I was sure things wouldn't work out with Jimmy. When we found the claw-footed bathtub, we both knew that was it. She disappeared into the forest of things, reemerged with a team of Hasidic men who hoisted the tub and deposited it on the sidewalk for us. The problem of what to do next hadn't occurred to us until we were standing there, two girls in a bathtub on a Bushwick street at the very height of summer. Two girls who had been asked to make an artwork for a party and who, drunk and flattered, had said yes. "We aren't artists, though," I'd whispered to Lulu, and she'd said, "Says who?" 20 minutes later, we had the tub up on two dollies, and I was in front, arms behind me, slipping off the bathtub lip, sweaty hands making it nearly impossible to keep a grip. Lulu was wearing platform slides and kept tripping as she pushed. When we hit the stretch of Metropolitan, where it narrows into a strip of grading over Newtown Creek, a line of cars and trucks built up behind us as the tub vibrated right off of its makeshift wheels. "Fix it!" we shouted at each other, each of our efforts less successful than the last, until a man dismounted from his cab, hauled the tub to the other side of the bridge, and left us to it, a round of applause from other motorists in his wake. We didn't make eye contact for a moment, Lulu and I, but when we did, we couldn't stop laughing. Later, at the party, we folded into the tub together, drinks in hand. I ran my pink manicured fingers over the cracked porcelain. The network of fine black lines sprawling across the white reminded me of river deltas. Lulu said capillaries, macro and micro. We were wearing little dresses, as we generally did back then, our bare legs entwined. I reached down to scratch a mosquito bite and got her calf instead. We were like one girl with two heads. All night long, people traded places with us. First, she climbed out, and this guy in an ill-fitting suit climbed in, giving me a sip from a flask he produced from inside his jacket. He was wearing a t-shirt under there. I waited to learn something from being too close to him, but the cheap fabric of his suit itched where it rubbed against my legs. I wiggled out of the tub, and so did he, raising his eyebrow at me like he'd been cheated. Lulu got back in with some girl she knew from college, and so on. One guy tripped getting out of the tub and gave himself a bloody nose. Lulu snapped a picture of it on the disposable camera she was keeping tucked under the spaghetti strap of her dress. It wasn't much later before it was the two of us in there again. The party was background noise. We tilted our heads toward each other, recapping, talking about how everyone had smelled, who kept their hands to themselves and who didn't. Jimmy, 15 years older than us, owner of the loft where the party raged, commissioner of our artwork, object of Lulu's thrift store wedding dress fantasies, crouched down beside us and said, "Huh, forced proximity," I said. Lulu continued, "You can't help but slide together in here." "You two look too comfortable," Jimmy said. "No one else has a chance." Lulu and I had been enjoying ourselves, drinking our beers. We'd been in there a while. Jimmy was right. That wasn't really the idea. So I flung a leg over each side of the tub, did an improbable hip thrust to lift myself out. I remember the move so well, my back arching, my dress falling up. Oh, the sounds my bones would make if I did that now. Standing up, I realized just how much I needed to pee. The backs of my thighs were red from where I'd peeled them off the porcelain. I clasped my hands and raised my arms in a stretch. Jimmy was in the tub with Lulu, his lips on her neck, and I already missed my friend. I was no artist. I went to find the bathroom. There was the time Jesse and I saw that a band we really liked was playing at the venue just a short drive from our place, and we threw on our shoes and rushed over, only to realize they'd played there the night before. That night, they were in Philadelphia. It seemed like another near miss. We'd almost gotten to see the band. We almost loved each other. This was almost working. Jesse leaned against the brick wall, the summer sun already fading into evening, his eyes on his phone. There was a bump in the bridge of his nose that was only visible in profile. How many people noticed that about him? I said, "Philadelphia isn't that far." The drive should have taken 2 hours, but it was three with traffic, and when we got to the show, they were already halfway through their set. We rushed in, full of the adrenaline of being late, of being a little lost, and somehow we were able to let it all hit us just the right way. We rolled that feeling over into the sound of the guitar, the momentum of the music, the pounding pulse of the room. The heat of all the bodies inside it turned it animal. We pressed into that heat, that mass, and it enveloped us. Holding hands, we jumped in time with the music and the floor shook. It wasn't a real venue, not a legal one, but the upstairs of someone's rickety building, and thinking back, I wonder if they even had the exits marked. But that wasn't something I worried about back then. It was like sweat was raining from the ceiling. Never before, nor again, did I have sweat in my eyes that probably wasn't even mine. I threw my head back as I sang along, unself-conscious about my terrible voice because it was so loud in there. The band was so loud, I could feel the music in my teeth. Jesse shouted in my ear that I had to open my eyes, and I did, even though they sung with salt, watching the guitar player hang backwards off the stage, her hair as wet as if she'd stepped out of the shower. She was borne aloft by the crowd, carried only so far before, of course, her guitar unplugged and she had to be returned to the stage. The music was so strange in that moment without her that the crowd, that we started singing the guitar part, becoming the instrument. When she was hooked up again and played her first note, we just screamed and screamed. We emptied our voices into that room. We turned ourselves inside out. After, once we found our car again, 3 blocks over from where we thought we'd left it, we stood outside of it, dripping. I said, "I think I have to wring out my shirt." So we stripped off our shirts, then our jeans, and twisted them, flapping them over our heads, laughing our faces off. We hadn't even had anything to drink, but we were giddy off of the show, the dehydration. We couldn't bear to put those damp clothes on again. We drove back to New York in our underwear. Mine was a set, plain black cotton, but Jesse's boxers were a bright turquoise, darkened at the waist with sweat. He was making up a silly song about being naked and in love on the Jersey Turnpike as the city appeared, far off, a string of lights on the horizon. My ears were still ringing, but I thought he sounded pretty good. There was the time I thought my water broke. On the phone, the nurse asked me to smell my pants to make sure it wasn't urine. My heart was beating so fast, I searched wildly for the chapstick someone had told me I absolutely had to have in my hospital bag, but I knew I hadn't packed, and she was asking me to smell my pants. They were my favorite maternity leggings, the ones with just enough stretch. After the whoosh of water, I'd peeled them and my underwear off, thrown them right into the tub, and called the doctor. Jesse had already left for work. With the nurse still on the phone, I picked them up off the damp shower floor with 2 fingers and sniffed. They smelled like my cherry blossom body wash. They smelled like that because I'd squirted it all over them. But whatever, I knew what it felt like to pee. I'd been doing it my whole life. This was different, so I told her, "No way, definitely not urine." My due date was a week away and my pants were wet. The baby was coming. I remember being absolutely sure in that moment that I would never, ever tell anyone about how I had to smell the crotch of my leggings to see if they smelled like pee. How mortifying. I thought I'd even forget it myself. Outside on Roosevelt Avenue, I tried to flag down a cab. The train was roaring overhead every few minutes, drowning out Jesse's voice on the phone. He kept saying he was going to come pick me up, but the car was here in Queens and I was worried about driving. What if my contractions started and I drove off the bridge? Recently, chunks of the actual train tracks had been shaking loose and falling onto cars or at the feet of passers-by, so I kept looking up in case I had to dodge metal. Each time I turned my head back to see the tail end of a lime green cab disappearing down the street, I was starting to panic. Lots of things about what was going to happen when I gave birth were still a mystery to me, but everyone had been quite clear that if my water broke, I was to report directly to L&D. I had some sort of blood thing. What was it called? Strep? The baby would need antibiotics. I was in clean leggings with a washcloth folded up in them because I hadn't bought those postpartum pads yet that I was supposed to get. And I had the go bag, sans chapstick, on my back, and I got on the bus. It was still rush hour. The bus was filled with people on their way to their jobs. Working from home, I didn't have all of those stories so many women in the city have about doing exaggerated belly rubs and back arches to get a seat on the train. A friend of mine wasn't offered one for the duration of her pregnancy until the day of her work baby shower when she boarded the train carrying a balloon that said, "Baby on the way." I was prepared to announce to the bus that I was in labor and needed to sit, but as we lurched into gear and people looked up, they were falling over themselves to get me situated. Of course, the front of the bus is where the old ladies sit in the section reserved for them. I wasn't about to displace an old lady, but I also wasn't about to fight one. 2 women had their hands on me, on my elbows and belly, and they lowered me down to a seat. "It's time," one of them said. She had a face made soft by lines, gray hair in a bun. I nodded. They could tell just by looking at me. I was sweating so much. She and the other woman spoke to each other over my head. I missed what they were saying, but imagined they thought I was an idiot for being on the bus. And it was true. The train probably would have been faster. Or I could have called a car service. The other woman, she had a handkerchief, and she literally mopped my brow. I felt like the dying heroine in a movie. It wasn't until she blotted my cheeks, too, that I discovered I was crying. This was the last time I'd be on the bus as a woman who wasn't a mother. The last time I'd pass by the good grocery store as a woman who wasn't a mother. The last time my baby would be a part of my body. The last time I wouldn't yet be a mother. I didn't even know the person I'd be the next time I was here. I would be a mother, a stranger. These women would know me as well as I knew myself. My eyes closed, hyperventilating with the strangeness of it all. Maybe I did look like I was in labor. I don't know where those women were going, but they stayed with me, on either side, holding my hands and murmuring to me like mothers, until I got off the bus. I was blocks away from the hospital still, because I hadn't paid any attention to what bus it was I was boarding, but I was in Manhattan and I could still walk. A few hours later, I was in a cab with Jesse, headed home. My water hadn't broken. The baby wasn't born for another 2 weeks. It was something I could have felt silly about, the time I peed my pants and was convinced I was in labor. But no, I didn't feel silly. Those mothers on the bus thought it was happening, too. I told the story to anyone who would listen.
Thank you, Nicole, for allowing us to read that delightful story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Wole Talabi. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them.
Across the bridge of stories, I'll find you.